So I have a question, and anyone who's not related to me by blood or marriage can answer. And I have backup in case nobody knows the answer. I'm going to rely on one of them. Who knows? Let me back up there. Who knows what the actually, or if you're in rabbinical school, don't answer. Who knows what the first law was that was given to the Israelites in the Torah? Anybody know? To basically, to, yes, thank you, to keep a guest. Thank you. It's good you're here. So the very first law that's given in the Torah is that God tells Moses to tell the children of Israel, this month shall be to you the first of months. When the Israelites were still in Egypt, God tells them, right as they're about to leave, right as the Exodus story begins and the Israelites are about to leave Egypt, to be freed from Egypt, God commands them to sanctify the new month every month. And the word that's used in the Torah is it says, Zeh, this month shall be to you. And the rabbis say that any time that God says Zeh, there's actually pointing going on. So it's an image of this little sliver of the new moon in the sky, and God is pointing to it so the people will know what to look for, what this new month will look like. And so this month shall be to you the first of months. Now the question is, why is that so very important? We could probably think of many other laws. I mean, if I probably asked you to rank order the importance of Jewish law, it would, which you're not supposed to do, it would probably take you a very long time to get to the calendar. You might think about laws about how we treat other people or other types of rituals or even laws about the Exodus itself. And so why is the calendar so important that this is the first thing that the Israelites need to know? So Rabbi Frankel, Alav HaShalom, used to like to ask the question, if a Jew was stranded on a desert island, what is the most important book that you would need to have with you as a Jew, not like as entertaining reading? So let me just ask if you... And if you think you know the answer, don't shout it out first because it ruins the whole, like, you know, the whole way I have this working in my mind. What kind of book, what do you think as a Jewish person, what book would be the most important book that you would need to have with you so that you could be a practicing Jew? How to Build a Boat. Thank you, Jonah. That's... This is what happens when you open it up and ask a question. No, that was good. Okay, what else? Let's say it took you a while to build the boat. In the meantime, what would you need to have with you? Tanakh, a Torah, a Siddur, calendar. Some of you remember Rabbi Frankel maybe teaching this. Quoting Samson Raphael Hirsch, who was a German rabbi in the 19th century, and he was best known as the intellectual founder of contemporary Orthodox Judaism. He suggested that the most important book that any Jewish person would need, if God forbid you were ever stranded, was a Jewish calendar, because you can't really be a practicing Jew if you don't know what day it is. But in ancient times, they clearly did not have a calendar the way that we have a calendar today. So the question was, how would you figure out if the month is based on the new moon? It's a little bit complicated. Our tradition is based on a lunar calendar, and a lunar cycle is complicated because each month is 29 days, 12 hours, and 44 minutes. This is the same time that it takes for the moon to orbit around the earth. And this is why we always say that Jewish holidays are either early or late, because it moves around the calendar. And of course, we Jewish people in our calendar, on occasion, there's an extra leap month so that our holidays stay in the same season and generally at the same time every year. Though I actually think with this bad rainy weather, the calendar got a little confused because it's supposed to be Sukkot when it rains every single day. So unlike the Muslim calendar, which doesn't have this sort of extra fixing month, and so their holidays cycle through the calendar at, you know, different seasons. So how would you know when a new month would begin and end in ancient times before you could check on your calendar? You needed to have two reliable witnesses that would verify that they saw the appearance of the new moon in the night sky. And it tells us in the Mishnah for Rosh Hashanah that the Beit Din in Jerusalem, the rabbinic court, had the responsibility of declaring the new month. And they would rely on these witnesses to make a sighting and report it to them. So you could have people all over the place looking at the night sky, waiting to see the sliver of the new moon, and then they would have to quickly get to the Beit Din in Jerusalem, because obviously time is passing, and so they could validate that it was the new moon. And this was considered so important that these witnesses arrived to the Beit Din that they were actually allowed even to violate Shabbat in order to get there. What's very interesting is that this was a task that was really charged to everyone. Everyone had to look into the sky. I don't know if they discuss women witnesses, so let's say every man had to look into the sky and look for this new moon. And it's interesting because the rabbis systematized all of Judaism for us, and they could have trained a professional class of moon gazers, right? It could have been, it could have been a position that was given only to the people that were the most expert. And so what would happen is lots of people would flock to Jerusalem. And we're told that they had a little kiddush, a little oneg, I don't know what, everybody that would come, you'd get a cookie, a little kichel, whatever you would get. As a total aside, I'm proud to say that our younger generation, Am Yisrael, probably doesn't know what kichel is because it does not appear at our kiddushes. Very proud of that. And we thank Nancy and Brian for that. In any case, everybody would get, a little something to eat, because why? You wanted to encourage people to come. And if only the people that were declared the valid witnesses, only they got a little snack, people would stop coming. And so the ancient rabbis wanted to encourage as many people, as many witnesses as they could, even though they really only needed two. And so the question is, why did you want really everybody to come? Too many people. Maybe the fear was that, if you didn't encourage people, maybe one month nobody would show up. But I heard an interesting, beautiful webinar with Micha Goodman, who's associated with the Hartman Institute. I have to say, this year, people always ask me, how do you come up with sermons? And, is there some organization somewhere that tells rabbis what they're supposed to speak about? Good luck with that. So no, there is no organization that tells us what to speak about. But more and more in the 26 years that I've been in the rabbinate, the Jewish Theological Seminary, the Rabbinical Assembly, Machon Hadar, the Hartman Institute do have wonderful High Holiday webinars. And hopefully, if we're fortunate, we hear something that we can use in a sermon. And so I heard a wonderful a piece by Micha Goodman talking about why was it so important to have, all of these people running to Jerusalem. And he called it a national project. It became a national project to have a community of moon gazers. And so he asked the question, which I'm nervous to ask. Wayne, you can answer this. What did pagans see when they looked at the moon? What did they see? What would you say that they... I'm going to put you on the spot here so I don't embarrass myself. What did they... Could we suggest that they saw either a god or a representation of a god when they looked at the moon? Would that be a fair... Okay, that's a fair statement. So when pagans looked at the moon, they saw something that perhaps was divine in its own right or represented a specific god. What were the Israelites supposed to see when they looked at the moon? So one thing, of course, that we are supposed to think about when we look at the moon is our very own creation story that we celebrate at Rosh Hashanah. And our creation story tells us, unlike perhaps in other pagan religions, that there isn't the God of the moon and the God of the sun and God of various things. What does our creation story come to tell us? How many gods? One, responsible for all of nature. That our God is responsible for all of nature. And so when we look up to the moon, perhaps we think about the glory of nature, the oneness of God, this beautiful gift of the moon from God. I have a friend, and you've probably, some of you have heard me say this, I have a rabbi friend who said, you know, she went to the national parks and she was surprised, like, where were all the Jews? So the question is, oh, well, what do you mean, where are all the Jews? And she said, I don't know, all the Jews that I know say they find God in nature, so I was expecting a lot more of them when I was traveling through the national parks. Samson Raphael Hirsch tells us that were the beginning of our months and consequently the dates of our festivals to be fixed exactly by the astronomical phases of the planets so that the moon automatically made Rosh Chodesh and the festivals, then we and God too would appear to be bound by the blind laws of nature, and our festivals of a new moon would perhaps lead us to idolatry of the cult of nature. So Samson Raphael Hirsch suggests that the partnership between God saying, this is the new month for you, and human beings having to actually declare that the month has begun, actually suggests that there's really a partnership between God and people in declaring the new moon. And there's actually, as Rabbi Frankel used to like to say, a well-known teaching to a small group of people about a rabbinic dispute as to actually when the new month would begin. And there was a dispute, and actually the majority forces the minority to accept the ruling of majority in the setting of the new month. Because there is a possibility that you could actually be wrong. You could see a moon that's real. Really, let's be honest. Could you tell the difference between the new moon on the first day or the second day or the third day? I mean, really? People can make mistakes. It could be, especially, you know, cloudy. Maybe you didn't see it. Maybe you thought you saw something, but you didn't see it. And so there's a lot of room for error. And the Beit Din, the ancient Beit Din in Israel, recognized this and said, but we have to do it anyways, right? We have to do the best that we can, given the fact that we're on this, you know, lunar calendar. And so they saw it as a partnership in declaring that which is holy between human beings and God, and I'd like to even go as far as to suggest that we have a say in setting sacred time. You know, I was thinking yesterday when I gave the brief introduction to Matovu, which talks about how beautiful the sanctuaries that we create, that we who are members at Am Yisrael have had an interesting experience in taking first a high school auditorium and then this beautiful performing arts center and making it sacred space. It's not that hard to make a synagogue sanctuary feel like a holy and special place. It takes a community of people, it takes an ark, it takes a Torah scroll, it takes our machzorim. I actually was here a few weeks ago for a performance, and I actually thought that I was going to be nervous walking in this building a few weeks before, you know, the big season. And I actually wasn't, because it felt like a performing arts space. It didn't feel like our sanctuary. It takes the community to come here together and to sanctify this space. But the moon is also seen in our tradition as a symbol of the people of Israel. The image of the sliver of the moon reappearing in the darkness and growing nightly into a full sphere, only to wane again, has been interpreted by some rabbis as a metaphor for the history of the Jewish people. At times, our people have suffered in darkness, and at times have even feared utter extinction. But just as the moon's light is continually renewed, so too are we supposed to draw reassurance that the Jewish people will again have a future that shines. The waxing and the waning of the moon can also be seen as symbolic of Jewish tradition and Jewish practice. The life of the spirit, both communally and individually, similarly shrinks and expands, grows dull and routinized, and hopefully, like the waxing and waning of the new moon, of the moon, that even though it can grow dull and routinized, there's always the possibility and the need for renewal and revitalization. And sometimes, you know, we ask the question in Judaism a lot, or we think about it a lot, you know, is it the best of times? Is it the worst of times? There's always the incredible fear, first of all, of anti-Semitism. I was saying last night at our holiday dinner table that I really actually believed as a young person in my 20s that anti-Semitism was done. That it was done. And when I would get, you know, something from a Jewish organization that, you know, that warned a new virulent strain of anti-Semitism, I was like, so overly dramatic. I'm really sorry to say how wrong I actually was and how incredibly naive I was in the really resurgence, or maybe it never, you know, went away, but it seems like a resurgence of anti-Semitism. But when we ask the question, sort of, is this the best of times, is this the worst of times, this is true of Jewish practice and observance as well. We look at people that are assimilated. We look at people that are moving away from the community that don't practice Judaism. We worry about young people not feeling connected and committed to their Judaism. And yet we look around at the amazing new organizations and institutions that are springing up around us, led by 20-somethings, focused on prayer, focused on tikkun olam, with a strong sense of Jewish identity, perhaps different than our own, certainly different from that of our grandparents, but no less committed. So it's really, Judaism is sort of this revolving door of people that seem to be coming and going at the same time. And so, it's, you know, for those of us that worry about these things, it sort of makes our heads spin. But at the same time, there's an awful lot of hope out there, like the waxing and the waning of the moon. Each time the moon finds the sun again, each time it receives its rays of light, Samson Raphael Hirsch teaches that God wants his people to find him again and to be illuminated with the fresh rays of light whenever and however in running their course. They've had to pass through periods of darkness and obscurity. The moon finding itself in conjunction with the sun is a model for us finding ourselves again with God. The rejuvenation of the moon, an incentive for our own rejuvenation. The rabbis also teach Moses is told this new month, right, Zeh, that what it says specifically is HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem. This new month is a month Lachem for you. That this renewal of the moon should be a beginning of renewal, not only for the people Israel, but actually for you, for each of us as an individual. That when we notice the fresh birth of the moon, we know that we as individuals can have the same kind of rejuvenation. When I first began my Rabbinic Leadership Institute at Hartman 5 years ago, one of the first things they asked us when they gathered our cohort together is, what's your go-to sermon? What's your go-to sermon? Every rabbi, there were 30 of us in the group, every rabbi in the room knew the answer to that question. What's your go-to sermon? I'm afraid that you guys probably know the answer to that too. She's speaking about this again? But I would say, maybe you don't, I'll tell you. We'll pretend that you don't. That my go-to sermon, it's a sermon that I find myself giving time and time again, is my fascination and my inspiration with the ability of people who suffer tragedy to be able to recreate their lives again. This past summer, I had a wonderful experience. Some of us were there together. One of our dear friends got married. He had been divorced. His wife had been divorced. And what I said to them under the chuppah is that this marriage, so happy, the two of them so happy together, so wonderful that they had found each other. And what I said to them under the chuppah was, no one gets to a second marriage without a fair share of pain and suffering. For whatever reason your first marriage ended, it either ended through the death of a spouse or through divorce, you haven't gotten to this chuppah unless you've gone through a great deal of pain and suffering. And yet, you find love again, and you choose love again. Hopelessly naive or unbelievably optimistic. But any time I do a second marriage, I feel like it really reminds us that people believe in love and that people can come through dark times and find happiness again. Many years ago, I did the wedding of a second wedding of a woman whose husband had passed away about 2 years before. And I went to her home to prepare for the funeral and shiva of her husband. It was a freezing, dark day in February, totally gray, so very sad. And 2 years later, I officiated at her wedding on a beautiful sunny day in June, and she said to me that day, she'd never thought that this would happen, and she said, life has an amazing way of recreating itself. And so the new moon reminds us, for each and every one of us, that life has an amazing way of recreating itself and that human beings have a resilience to be able to do that. The renewal of body, the renewal of spirit, is a prayer that we sing every Shabbat, and we sang it this morning, the beautiful Debbie Friedman tune, where we pray for Mishaberach, for healing, not only for healing of our bodies, but healing of our spirits. The mystics of our tradition attributed great significance to the order of the shofar blasts. They had special kavanot, intentions, where they would meditate on these blasts, and they would note that first we begin with a tikiyah, a whole note, and then it proceeds with a shvarim, a broken note that's divided into three parts, or even a truah, an entirely fragmented sound. But each broken note is followed by another whole note, another tikiyah. And this, they say, is the message of Rosh Hashanah. I started off whole, I became broken, even splintered into fragments, but I can become whole again, and I shall become whole again. In our tradition, we announce the new month, the Shabbat before the month begins, every single month, except for Tishrei. So we're asking the tradition, why? Why don't we do Tishrei? So there's actually two answers given. The first answer is, because everybody knows it's coming. There's kind of a truth to that if you think about it, right? I mean, you may not know. I mean, eventually you look in the calendar probably more than, all right, let's just ask the question. Who knew before last Shabbat that it was going to be Rosh Hashanah? Because you thought to look, right? You cared enough to look. You figured it out. You had plans to make. The other reason that's given just is that we're on trial today, and we don't really want to notify the prosecuting angel, Satan, that Rosh Hashanah is coming. Maybe he won't think to look in a calendar, will miss the fact that Tishrei is coming, and won't be as well prepared in the case against us. So we all knew that it was coming. At the congregation, we basically have known that it was coming since the end of Pesach. But we don't need to miss this opportunity. We don't need to miss this opportunity for renewal. As we gather this Rosh Hashanah morning, we feel the newness in the air. We see it in the turn of the leaves. And we sense the hope and the possibility stirring inside. Like school children, we sit attentively waiting, asking, praying, though sometimes unsure of the words and sometimes unsure of to whom they're even addressed. We struggle to understand to peek behind the curtain of a 3,000-year-old tradition that has sustained our people, hoping that there is some nugget of wisdom that's just for us. A word or a melody that might tug at your heartstrings, send you into a deep, quiet place of listening so that you can open up a new path inside. The places of struggle, unrest, inner turmoil, these are the things that we want to change, and this is the work of tshuva. And coming today reminds us that there are ways to be in the world, to make different choices, and to live life with a new perspective. And so we ask, may we have the strength to be vulnerable, the humility to be connected, and may the strength of this community and the chorus of other voices give each of us strength to make the changes in our lives so that in deed and in speech, it will truly be a Shana Tovah.